Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. As ever, we're delighted. The films Aga, Manos, and Judy, which is really tempting, but again, hi, David, how are you?
Doing okay, Jill. I know that you just love to make sentences out of our movie titles, but this week we have a grand total of three movies with one-word titles, which is not why I chose to put them together. They just all happen to be right out there playing on the theatrical circuit at this very moment, so here they are. And they are, apart from their one-word titles, very different kinds of movies, although I guess that each one of them has a kind of a sociological interest. But let's start with Aga. Aga is a co-production from Bulgaria, Germany, and France, which only means sort of where the financing came from, but it's obviously a very international co-production. And Aga was filmed, it appears, in Siberia, certainly in some very far-flung part of the former Soviet Union. And it deals with people who live there. And they are basically, it's kind of interesting. There's two main characters in this movie. Another character shows up during the story for a while, and a fourth character comes in at the very end. But mainly this movie is about two people, and their names are Nanook and Sedna. Now, Nanook was the name of the main character of one of the most famous documentaries ever made, a movie called Nanook of the North, a silent movie made by the great Robert Flaherty back in the 1920s. And Nanook of the North is a very controversial film because Flaherty famously faked a lot of stuff because he couldn't, you know, filming in the 1920s, in that case in what became Alaska, he was not able to get everything he wanted just with his cameras, so certain things he had to sort of fake, like sort of building a fake igloo so that he could manage to get some light in it to film with his camera and so forth. But still in all, Nanook of the North definitely gives a very vivid picture of a way of life that was very little known in the 1920s and that has long since, I'm sure, largely vanished. So by naming one of the characters Nanook, one of the main characters, I think that the director of Aga, whose name is Milko Lazarov, was referring to that earlier very famous documentary from the 1920s. But still, we have here a very different kind of a film. Now, the two main characters, Nanook and his wife, live in a yurt way out in the very snowy, icy wilderness. I mean, this is one of those movies where pretty much everything is just sort of blindingly white. Everything. We're way out in snow and ice country. And these two live alone. They live a very, very isolated life. And there are changes afoot, which the movie only suggests rather than really getting into. For example, obviously reindeer are a big part of their life. They apparently have been reindeer herders, although they now don't appear to have any reindeer left, and they have to sort of go foraging around and ice fishing and so forth. So is this due to climate change? Well, probably it is, that this change in the presence of the reindeer, but the movie never gets into that because these are not sophisticated people. They are people who probably know very little about climate change, if anything at all, even though they may be suffering from some of the results of it. So what we basically do is, for the approximately hour and a half of this movie, is to spend time with these two and see their daily routine. And it's kind of the routine that you sort of might expect. The man goes out and does some fishing and does some looking around for game. They're trapping some small animals and things like that. And the woman stays home and tries to do some cooking and this and that. They have some semi-modern conveniences. They have a large metal stove, for example. But basically, it's a kind of way of life that probably probably has been pretty much unchanged for many, many, many decades, and in some ways perhaps for centuries. So that is what the movie is about. And then long, long into the movie, they get a visitor who is apparently their grown son, who is working at a diamond mine somewhere else. And there is talk about another character, apparently an estranged daughter, although the movie never gets very clear about these things. And then a tragedy happens within the little household. And at the end of the movie, we have the main male character, Nanook, going off in search of both the visitor who they had and the estranged, what appears to be the estranged daughter. And that's when the film comes to an end. It's a movie that seems to operate in this sort of boundary, borderland, Neverland maybe, in between documentary and fiction. It really is filmed like a documentary, and it is a gorgeous film to look at, as spare and minimalist as it is, and as I said, just all this whiteness of snow and ice just sort of everywhere. It's still just a stunning film to look at, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. It's just an absolutely marvelous visual experience. The story I also found riveting, even though almost nothing happens in the movie. Still, the events are paced in such a way, very slowly, but each time something did happen, I would be drawn back into the narrative line of the film, and I found that very compelling also. Not everybody loves AGA. Did not get a very good review in the New York Times, for example, but I found it just a very, very almost mesmerizing experience that really drew me in, held me all the way, and I really do recommend it. It's not going to be playing in multiplexes everywhere, but I found it just a very compelling and beautiful movie to watch, and in its own quiet way, a very poignant story. Turning to our second film, Manos, a moment ago I got ahead of myself. Now we have a movie which is a co-production from Colombia, Argentina, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Uruguay, Switzerland, Denmark, and the United States of America. So a whole lot of resources from many, many different places went into the making of this film, which was directed by Alejandro Landes. And it is a movie which has been compared with Lord of the Flies, although I don't think that's a very good comparison. For moments I will give in a moment. The movie Manos deals with a bunch of very young people. Basically, they're adolescents. And they are on a mountaintop somewhere in Latin America. We're never told exactly where. And they are some sort of apparently insurgent battle force, part of a larger organization, because at the very beginning of the movie, they are hearing from some commander who has come in from somewhere else and who is barking out all kinds of orders at them and so forth. But then that commander goes away, and the adolescents are all in charge of themselves. They are just known as the organization. The name of their particular group is apparently Manos, which apparently means monkey. And all of the adolescents there have these names which they call each other, names like Dog, Rambo, Lady, Wolf, Boom Boom, names like this. And they have a cow, which they are given at the very beginning of the movie, a milk cow, because they have to have their vitamins, their commander tells them during the time he's there. And they're to be very, very careful of the milk cow and not let anything happen to the cow, because first of all, it's on loan. And secondly, they really need that milk. Something very bad does happen to the cow, by the way, and it doesn't take very long for that to happen. And they also have, interestingly, a prisoner, an American prisoner, a woman, an engineer, who has been kidnapped and who is their hostage. So that is what we have, and that is pretty much all that the movie is about, is this group of young guerrilla fighters, all of whom are adolescents. Their hostage, who is known as Doctora for some reason, even though she's an engineer, not a doctor, and their cow. And again, the movie has – and we have various adventures that they go through, and there are quarrels, sometimes violent quarrels within the ranks of this little group, and there is the tension of trying to keep their hostage, and at one point late in the film, they have to move to another location. The hostage gets away a couple of times, and they have to try to recapture the hostage, etc. The movie, as I said, has been compared with Lord of the Flies. I do not think that that is a good comparison, because the point of Lord of the Flies is that these are very civilized youngsters who find themselves, after some sort of cataclysmic war, alone in this island, and they revert to a primitive condition. Not a whole lot of reversion goes on in Manos. These young people appear to be pretty savage, pretty feral, pretty primitive on their own. They apparently have never been through a whole lot of a civilizing process. We're never really sure where they came from, whether they came from the countryside or whether they came from a city or what. But they certainly, right from the beginning of the movie straight through to the end of the movie, seem to be, again, a very primitive lot. So I don't think this is a Lord of the Flies movie. It has been getting ecstatic reviews from almost everybody, people who praise the naturalism of the acting and of the settings and so forth, and the kind of ferocious concentration of the story and how it kind of sheds light on what people and even young people might be like when if they were left in sort of a primitive condition with nothing now to no civilizing forces around them. I found the movie kind of monotonous. It kind of goes on and on, and yes, there's a fair amount of drama within it, but the characters are not really all that delineated. Yes, we can tell one from another, and they have their different personalities, although their personalities seem to be largely pretty much the same, a whole lot of, again, kind of primal ferociousness. I didn't find the characters very interesting as individuals. I didn't find them very interestingly drawn. And even though the movie is amazingly well shot with all kinds of, you know, astonishing fighting scenes and so forth, after a while I have to say, get sort of tired of it. So even though it's been getting, again, very, very, very positive reviews from almost everybody, I can't really give it my highest recommendation. If you're interested in subjects like guerrilla fighting and like the sort of tensions that exist in some of the parts of the world where there is all too much ferociousness going on, especially out in the countryside, it is definitely a movie with some political and sociological interest in those ways. But I didn't find it a movie that deserves my highest rating. An interesting film, but certainly not a great one in my not so humble opinion. And finally, our third movie today, which is the one that's playing sort of everywhere, and this is Judy, which is directed by Rupert Gould, who's a fairly new filmmaker, has not done a whole lot of work before now, and features a performance by Renee Zellweger as Judy Garland, which has been getting an enormous amount of praise, and which I suppose will be a player when the Academy and other awards season comes up soon. Judy is about Judy Garland in her later years. It takes place in 1968, really not long before she died. And she arrives in London to give a series of concerts, but she is the Judy Garland who we know from legend in her unfortunate later stages of life. She is really pretty strung out on pills and alcohol. And even though the movie does not present her as any sort of an invalid, she is definitely not in very good shape. And the movie goes back and forth, but most of it takes place in 1968 when she is in London to give these concerts. But we definitely have flashbacks, quite a few of them, to earlier stages in her life, including her years of filming The Wizard of Oz, the movie that, of course, made her a gigantic international superstar for the rest of her life. And by the way, she didn't live even close to the age of 50. So it was a very unhappy life that she led and that we see in the movie. We see back in the Wizard of Oz days, we see her many conversations with Louis B. Mayer, the head of the studio, MGM, and we see her being literally doctored with pills, uppers and downers, to keep her as a very young actress able to work from day to day. And she's not very happy with the situation, and she's not very happy with how MGM is treating her, and she is not enjoying the filming process, and she wants to just be a girl. She wants to be a young woman. She wants to be somebody who has an ordinary life. But instead she's stuck in this studio life of being groomed to be one of the big stars and again being plied, and not just plied but manipulated with medications and whatnot in order to get her to that situation. So most of the movie shows her near the end of her life when she is now living with the fruits of all this, which she did not bring upon herself and which she in fact tried to get out of, but where she, her life has been turned into a pretty unhappy phenomenon, even though she is an international star and everyone in London wants to come and see her concerts. Again, a lot of the movie focuses on her, you know, her interactions with other people, including her young assistant who she is given to help her out in London, to sort of be with her all the time, a young woman named Rosalind Wilder, who was played wonderfully by Jessie Buckley, who was so sensational just a few months ago in the movie Wild Rose, where she plays a Scottish country singer. Jessie Buckley is really gives the finest supporting performance in this movie, although there are other good people in the movie as well, including Rufus Sewell and Michael Gambon and a few others. I actually saw Judy Garland in concert about a year before this movie takes place. I saw her in Boston way back in 1967. It was not her big famous outdoor concert that she gave in Boston. It was an indoor concert right around that time. And I remember Judy Garland as not being in the best of shape then. She complained about being exhausted. She complained about perspiring too much. At one point, she just halted the concert to go off and change her dress off stage. And people in the audience, her devoted fans, were yelling, "We'll wait for you, Judy!" And I'm sort of thinking, my goodness, she's a wonderful singer, but she is really not quite up to snuff here in this concert. And again, that was about a year before she died. And the movie Judy takes place even later than that, really in her final months. Renee Zellweger gives a fine performance. The big flaw of the movie, and I'm the first person to mention this, is that we do not have Judy Garland's voice. We have Renee Zellweger imitating Judy Garland's voice. The movie sorely needs Judy Garland's voice. I wish that for the few musical numbers that are in it, that they had simply dubbed Judy Garland's voice. Aside from that, it's a good movie, not a great one, one of the better biopics we've seen lately, and Renee Zellweger probably will be all up for all sorts of awards pretty soon, and she will, I would say, sort of deserve them. And that is my somewhat mixed story this week, Jill.
Sort of. Thank you very much, David Sterrett. Films in Focus, the films Aga, Manus, and Judy.